Hello again. It's my pleasure to welcome today's keynote speaker, Dr. Bhaduri of the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. So let's give him a warm round of applause. Thank you.
Good morning. It's a rather shy audience.
Not really.
Come on. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Eddie and Carter and everybody who conspired to get me here and waste some of your time. I think this is a fantastic gathering of colleagues. I just could not pass up my chance to come and throw ideas. So we went back and forth about what the title of this talk should be, and you have seen on social media that Eddie was putting out that open source software or open source data. And just like a competent keynote speaker, I thought at the last moment that, you know, it needs to change to something more important. And so I tweaked it a little bit and changed it to open source data, software, and ambitions. The reason I feel that's important is because I'm going to spend more time, probably during my allocated 20 minutes, in talking about things that I have been thinking a lot. My colleagues at Oak Ridge has been thinking a lot about, you know, where do we go? You know, what are the possibilities of, you know, as a community making some progress here. So. I'm going to, you know, most of you know who I am, and I've been around with you for a long time, so I'll spare you the introduction. That's not important, but I'm going to save every second that I have of the 20 minutes to talk about these ideas. So a little bit about, you know, our commitment, and the good thing about going, Aaron going before me, is that you have already gotten a taste of some of the things that we are doing, and I have some of the same slides, so I'll skip over them. But I want to just touch on them because it's part of the story. I want to talk open source data and open source software in the context of geospatial digital twins. And I know it's a heavily used and sometimes feels like heavily abused phrase. But I think it's important that we share our thoughts around it, where we think we are going with a geospatial digital twin. And at the very end, if there is time, I have two slides to share something that I feel I have personally thought for a while now, and I keep thinking about it. Haven't made much progress, but since, you know, I have the opportunity to, you know, share that idea with all of you, I'll be curious about feedback. Okay, so. Aaron was generous enough to generate this slide for me. You know, increasingly, I've been at Oak Ridge for 26 years, and I would say that the biggest change that has happened over the 26 years is our commitment and our usage of open source software and open source tools for everything that we do. And, you know, we are a fairly large operation in geospatial science and technology. And it's amazing to see how open source tools, from data storage to web services to analytics, mapping, and of course on HPC side, which we use a lot, high-performance computing, everything is coming from open source technology. And they are producing, underlying everything that we give out to the community. As an open resource, are these technologies. So how many people have never heard of LandScan population data? Thank you. Not a single hand. So just so you know, this is a remarkable year because this is the 25th year of producing LandScan global data set for the community. That's a remarkable achievement for any community to have a data set served for 25 years. It's not that easy. Even musical bands don't last that long. Okay? So this is now a wide open resource for the entire community, a global community, and we are extremely proud of it. So open data is serving. Aaron talked about our partnership with the Department of Homeland Security, which started with S&T, now longstanding partnership with FEMA, and creating a data resource that's going out there. 125 million plus structures in the entire United States, 450 square feet and larger. And the 450 square feet is not random. That's the size of an average mobile home park. That's where we started, mapping the mobile home parks, and then that's where it progressed. So this is amazing, you know, and then the open source AI technologies are really remarkable because only 3.5% of our land surface has a building in the nation. And if you go to the other countries, it goes into less than 1%. Aaron talked about Eagle Eye, you know, how we are collecting Eagle Eye sharing the data with the community for making both operational improvement and scientific progress. I want to make sure that you retain one thing out of this slide, which is that the data is sort of near real time, and every 15 minutes there is a status update. And I'll explain why I'm asking you to do that. You heard about Odin, that Supriya Chintawali is leading with Chris Irwin at DOE. And this is a remarkable effort that has a strong support from the White House in creating open data standards that utilities can use to report outages. So it's a very, very powerful movement in the open data standards. And you can see the number of entities that are already being there. All right, so I'm going to jump into geospatial digital twin with the acknowledgement that this presentation goes back into a beer drinking session right before Christmas of 2023. It's amazing how a little bit of alcohol can bring out creativity. Okay? I'm sure I don't have to tell you that, but it is fairly amazing. So Dave Page and Carter, they have the majority of credit for this, and I'm just on the stage sharing this idea. We have been with AI and big compute and lots of Earth observation. One thing that we have pretty much mastered is how do we map the heck out of the planet? Just map everything that you can see in imagery. It has come a long way. You saw that we now can do buildings. You know, we have recently done a benchmark of mapping water bodies that Mike Tischler, I need to talk to you about. And that shows that if we take commercial imagery, we can map every water body in the US at the rate of, less than a day using the big machine that sits at Oak Ridge. Okay? Every small water body you can map. So it's pretty unprecedented accuracy, speed, so we can do it over and over and over. But do we need to? That's the question. Clearly, you know, the data resource, the foundation data for the planet is going to a new phase where we can map them at very high accuracy, at very high resolution, and then we can maintain them with the technology out there. Which allows us to, you know, take AI to the next level, which is, you know, can you autonomously monitor without having humans in the loop or minimizing the role of humans in the loop? So, I think we are going to see more and more of that kind of an approach, saying, you know, what can you tell without people looking at imagery and continuously being connected? Dynamically update and maintain attributes. Attributes are the next challenge, next level of challenge is not mapping the buildings, but what else can you talk about? Tell me about the buildings. So having those is important. Now, you know, the global community has always thought about this as a dream, like one-to-one map or a digital Earth. Can we digitize everything and put it in a form? I don't think we have gone away from that. I think we still have that ambition. We want to do it. Deep down, we are all interested in, and that's why Google Earth first captured everybody's imagination. It felt like you knew everything about the planet and you could just surf on the web. So this is very exciting. Aaron showed what, there are two mentions of drones. We collect data at the edge and all the way to, we collect, massive amounts of data from Earth observation satellites, and then we use high-performance computing process. So it's a total workflow ecosystem. So what's the big challenge, okay? So I grabbed this map from Google, and all of you are familiar with this map. We use map every day. We produce map every day. My point is that the only foundation feature that's dynamic on this map is water, okay? And we represent water with a blue line or a blue polygon, okay? So this is somewhere in Spain, and there is a stream. And let's say I am there today, and I would like to go out and be next to the stream. So how do I know the stream looks like this or like this? Okay? In a technology today, we cannot do it. It's not possible for us to do it. So this challenge is for everybody's, right? The warfighter has the same challenge, that do they go out and do they walk over the streams, or do they need special equipment to go over? Our responders that in the utilities, in the SF-12, they have the same thing, saying, don't tell me the area is flooded. There was a major storm that just blew through. Of course I know it's flooded. Tell me how deep the water is. So can I take my truck, or do I need to haul a boat to go and repair the substation? So it's amazing. It's pretty humbling that we cannot do this today. So Dave did a great job of going back through history and kind of putting these approaches into four buckets, okay? There is a physical world, and there is the virtual world, and the green arrow represents a digital thread versus the red arrow is like a manual process, okay? So we started with creating geographic data with these digital models where we knew what the physical world looked like, and humans created data, and then we back and forth. Then came digital shadow, which is sort of weather forecasting. I know something about the physical world. I ingest that data into my virtual thing, and then I create a workflow that creates the forecast. Digital clone is another term that the community has used, which is geographic exploration system. So these are Google Earths of the world, where it's just one way. You just don't get anything back into the physical world. It's just feeding you one way. In a true geospatial digital twin, that workflow, that digital thread has to work in both direction, okay? And that's where we feel the key challenge and the opportunity is about this twinning rate. How fast can you twin? So I talked about Landscan global population data. It twins once a year, okay, for the community. We update data periodically depending on what's going on somewhere, but the community, it only updates once a year, so it's once. Eagle Eye is 15 minutes twinning, okay? The building structures, I don't know, we have not quite gone there yet, but maybe, we will twin at a certain rate. So everything has a twinning rate, and not everything needs to twin in real time. That's the other thing. So this is a great example of what the difference between a digital model versus a digital twin, right? MapQuest was a digital model. It had the, virtualized data from the physical world. You went there, you asked for directions, and it did it. And then you printed the map and you ran with it. It's like AAA triptychs, okay? That's the digital model. Waze is a digital twin, but it's only the digital twin of traffic condition. The base map in the background does not change. The only thing that updates in near real time is the traffic. And on top of that, there is one simple algorithm or model that is built, which is routing. And then there is a sub-model that hangs from it, which is doing a spatial search. I want to go from, like yesterday I did it. I went from Purdue University, drove down to Indianapolis Airport. I said, tell me the route I should take, and it did. And I said, also tell me all the gas stations that I could hit without, and it did two simple operations. But Waze doesn't want to, you know, try to do you anything more. Just find points of interest and give me a route. So it's a good example of a digital twin. So this is where I'm going to challenge everybody in this room, and I know a lot of you, is because you live this world. This is how we, for decades, have produced data, okay? It's a very manually intensive process that starts on the left and goes through these steps and ultimately creates something to the right. Anybody disputes this workflow? Because otherwise I'll save time. I know that most of you live, a lot of you live this world, okay? So this has been historical, and the origin is this because there we had limited capacity and capability to do compute and processing data. But somehow the technology has moved and evolved, but we haven't. So, you know, we are still doing this to a lot of extent. And what happens is that we produce data as products, and that's where we focus, that our value is that ultimate product. Is what is that data set, and we version it, okay? LandScan 2011, that's a version of data. That's how it goes. So here is a great example, okay? This is a major contribution from the US government to the rest of the world. Science and operations relies on this today. It's a global elevation data. It started in year 2000, and version 1 in 30 meter for the US was released in 2003 version. 2005 was version 2.1, 90 meter global, okay? 2011, DLR comes out and says, oh, here you go, a 30 meter global. So we responded in 2013 by saying, okay, version 3.0, 30 meter global elevation data, okay? I don't have to tell you, you can do the math how long it took for us to go from collecting the data to creating a global data product, okay? Now, we can do better than that. And that's where I think this whole open source, open data approach is revolutionizing the way we are approaching this. So we are focusing on the twinning, right? And now we have big machines. So it's a paradigm shift from creating silos of data to just focusing on that digital threads, right? So the focus is not on the product anymore. The focus is on the process, okay? So I'll give you an example. This is a partnership with NGA where we are taking fortuitous stereo pairs that are sitting. You know, the government spent $300 million plus buying high-resolution commercial data for every year, okay? This sits in somewhere in the storage. And we were able to find, you know, sort of optimal, you know, within 40 degrees, like overlaps for stereo, and take an established open source algorithm, make it work on GPUs, scale it on a large cluster, and today we can map a size of Alaska in 12 hours. Okay, 2 meter resolution elevation data. So, new things are possible, okay? Now here, the focus is not on the product, the focus is on the process. So as you are creating the skin, that skin is alive, that's the one that lives. You are twinning at different rates, at different places. As you get data, you are updating that base, okay? That never gets versioned. What gets versioned is the product that you ultimately generate, that map. That's what you version, not the data, because the data is continuously evolving, because that's what we have worked towards, right? That how we can ingest a lot of data and move it through. So this is super exciting, and you know, for areas like in the poles, you can do it much faster because, you know, most of our satellites are polar orbiting, so you have a lot more access to. And you can do this with, you know, Meta is doing something, land use, land cover, and, you know, name it. We can do this. So going back to the stream, okay? What can I do about the stream? So one thing that we know that, okay, we can have real-time sensor integration. That's been discussed as part of a digital twin, is you have stream gauges, you can have cameras, and you can say, okay, I know what the stream is looking like, how much water is in there. The second one is the farmer's almanac, knowledge-based predictions. That is, I have lots of observation of these streams for the last 30 years, and based upon that, I can tell you that on average, on April 30th, the stream is likely to look like this. This much water is going to be there. That's a simple statistical machine learning type of approach that you can do, provided you have confidence that the future actually is indicative of the future, you know, projections, which is not entirely true anymore, given, you know, what's going on. If you believe what the scientific community is telling you about the changes that are happening, that are abrupt. The third option is you can now start modeling, coupling process models with your twin. That means you have a rainfall runoff model, and you can say, yesterday it rained for 24 hours nonstop. So I am going to couple that with my observational data and tell you that it's going to be higher than average. Okay? And we have all been trained to produce a plus minus sign after numbers. We can move, make those things there. The last one, which is the true indication of, you know, whether you are really having a digital twin, is your ability to forecast. So Eddie asked that question. I don't know whether he saw my slides or not, or he cheated, but that's an important question. Everybody wants predictive capability. Now, all of you live in Washington, and you know how lightning rod that word prediction is, right? So this is where you trust your scientist brethren, because we have come up with a word that is a little fuzzy, which is forecast, okay? Forecast takes that edge away, and people, you know, the common public knows that weather forecast you are not supposed to believe, right? So forecast is a good word. It's a kosher word. But I would like to know, you know, not just today, but tell me 3 hours from now when I'm coming back from wherever I'm going after crossing that stream, is it still going to be dry? Or 7 days back, if I am coming back, it's going to be dry. And that's a real question. The utility workers who go out to restore these substations, you tell them that, okay, take your truck over that bridge. It's okay, right? They want to know in 5 hours, is that bridge going to be still dry or is it going to be under 5 feet of water? Okay? That's the forecasting capability that you need at different timescales. So this will take an entire community to build and sustain. We will not have, so what examples that you are seeing, or at least I am seeing out there, is everybody is building a digital twin of, yesterday at Purdue, they said they're building a digital twin of the Wabash River watershed. So that's all they care about, right? And you will see, you know, I'm going to build a fund for the border, I'm going to build one for my city, like Cleveland Metro Park region. It's okay. Let everybody build. But if we have a way, if you start thinking smartly, that how could we incorporate everybody's contribution into this big digital twin, everybody wins, right? Everybody's contribution is valuable. All right, so here is where I'm going to get into dangerous territory, okay? Which is my favorite thing about open data economy. And I don't know if any of you have heard me say this. I've talked about this periodically at meetings. You know, I 2 weeks back, I was at AAG annual meeting in Honolulu, and I was asked that, you know, what is the next 10 years of human dynamics research? What are we going to know in human dynamics? And I basically said that, you know, we have done a lot, but we still have not made very good progress in terms of having a good, confident way of collecting data about consumer behavior, okay? When do we charge our cars? When do we, you know, go to the movie theaters? When do we, you know, do different things? Consumer behavior that drives our energy uses, that drives our infrastructure planning, Right? It feels strange, but trust me, we will not be able to, you know, realize the EV dream unless we know how people are going to move around so we can position these EV chargers, right? So it's a thing. Space-time activity trails. We all felt that that was kind of iffy and lots of privacy, and then after COVID, we have a different view of that now, right? That I would like to know my space-time trail and where I'm going, and I would like to know what I'm intersecting, right? So space-time trails are important. The third one is, this is the new thing that is out there in the community, is health and biometric. At an individual level, all the things that you can collect and discuss about your data, your health at an aggregated level, and your biometric data. If you feel that this is crazy, Google Colorado and brainwaves data. So there are companies which are buying people's brainwaves. And Colorado, 2 or 3 weeks back, passed a law banning that. Because they want to know, you know, that's where we are headed, is how do people react to different things? So the brainwaves are now up for sale. So this is real, okay? So the question is, all these data sets that I am talking about here are owned by individuals, like you and me, okay? So the way we have our data economy organized today is we all in this room produce those data sets, and they somehow get aggregated through these intermediate commercial layer, like my utility has everybody's energy usage data, or the customer subscriber's energy usage data. Apple has all my space time trail data from my iPhone. You know, Google has my space time trail from my Gmail login. And you can just name it, right? Including your the car you drive, that VIN number, right? That VIN number, that is a state assigned number. Then the state, the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, they sell it. And there is a company in Michigan called Polk. They kind of clean it up. So if you moved from one state to the other in the same year, you know, they make sure that it doesn't get double counted. And then they sell that data for an enormous amount of money, because every VIN number is sort of a digital print or identity of your car. It says the 16-digit basically tells you what car is it, what make is it, what kind of engine is in there, right? So you can. The insurance companies are now giving you Credit Karma. I recently had to get that app. Credit Karma has this feature where you can tell it to collect your driving habit data, and that they can share it with your the car insurance companies, and they will offer you a service. And it has control. That's the thing that I found interesting, that it has control. It says you will be able to kind of take out some data sets that you don't feel are representative of it, right? So it is real, right? So the question is, how much money have you made from your data yet? Okay? And that's where I feel this open data economy needs to go. If you go ask the community saying, what has been the major revolution in transportation, everybody will tell you it's the ride share. And we will believe it. Okay? Ride share has zero things to do with transportation. The cars are the same. It's the only the technology which has allowed individuals to participate in that economy. That's why you cannot kill it. That's the model of sustainability, is that if you make average person make money out of an activity, and everybody wants to do that, everybody wants to be rich, and everybody wants to live longer, okay? So anything that you do, if you can tie that to that metric, you are golden. But think about this, right? This is why you cannot kill Uber and Lyft. So if we really want our data ecosystem to be sustainable in the long term, I think we should think about that as, you know, that how do we make this marketplace for anyone and everyone? Because at the end, that's where the data is coming from, okay?
All right, so.
I think I've taken longer than the 20 minutes I promised. But I welcome your thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you, Buter. That was fantastic. And you know, you could take another 20 minutes and keep going just like that, and I would be totally fixated. Those of you who've paid close attention to the program will note that it says at this point it's a fireside chat between Dr. Baduri and Nadine Alame, and I am obviously not Nadine Alame. She is stuck in travel and cannot be here today and sends her regrets and wishes that she could be here. But so I'm going to step in and try feebly to fill in her shoes. So moving on.
All right, well, thank you for that talk. That was quite informative. So I think with the time I have left, I'll start us off with a question, then we'll throw it out to the audience. As I was digesting your discussion of digital twins and the twinning rate and things like that, I'm obviously thinking about the amount of data that goes back and forth and the frequency with which it does. And it sort of made me think about, you know, the hot topic everyone is talking about today, which is not just AI, but generative AI. I think in terms of the digital twins is sort of reflecting what we give it back, but in a digital way. We're sort of keeping it in sync. And that's relatively understandable. But that could also end up being a source for feeding into AI models and generative AI, and I wonder if I could get your thoughts a little bit on, you know, the opportunities you see there as well as the risks. I mean, we're all relatively familiar with the concept of hallucinations now, so there's definitely risks with that. Where do you see things going with that, and how do you think, like, government can take advantage of it?
That's a brilliant question. My personal impression is that we need to first not treat AI as a monolith, like, you know, just it is a thing. I have found a lot of comfort and peace in thinking AI as in AI for something. Okay, there has to be an application or an, you know, some kind of a direct use for AI. It's not immune from abuse. You know, there is a lot of concerns about that. Especially the academic community has been thinking about biases in AI models. Who gets to train the AI, who has access to AI, and who doesn't. It can create a disparate world pretty quickly. But it does have, certain advantages. That's why we are all attracted to it. If it makes life easier, it will survive and sustain. So generative AI is powerful. Clearly people are fascinated by the large language models. Again, at the AAG meeting, we did an experiment to see, you know, how geographically smart the large language models are. So we asked ChatGPT that said, my commute is really good. It is downhill both ways. And it caught it. It said, that's pretty humorous. Okay? And it explained that why it is not possible unless you are taking a different route, not coming back on the same. So there is geographic smartness built into this. The reason I go back to this, you know, AI for something, and I go back to, you know, how the metrics of economic strength and health, individual health, is it's always going to win. I think, you know, we have tried it with machine learning, but I think we are getting a little more confident with AI. If I could have AI predict that I will have a health crisis tomorrow, I think I will take it without a single doubt, right? We try to do this for, you know, predicting, you know, are you going to have a heart attack or are you going to have a stroke? And so health is a very important aspect of this. And I'll tell you that we will take it. Okay? We will accept it if that comes down to, you know, that's the forecasting prediction capability with AI. In the data space, I think that's where you had a, you know, kind of alluding to that aspect. In the data space, what would be useful is to see whether AI can create products that we have not thought before. So right now, everything that AI is doing is something that we have already thought before of what is important and what we need to collect and put it on a map, for example. But are there things that we don't necessarily see that an AI engine can see before humans would recognize that as an important thing, right? I don't know. I don't know whether, you know, how close or how far we are. But it's going to, you know, AI is going to create a lot of important nuggets for us out there in terms of our cognition and our understanding and interpretation of the world as we look at data.
Excellent. Thank you. So I'd like to throw it out to the audience, see if anyone else has any questions for Dr. Bedouri. And I know we have a mic runner out there or two somewhere. So just go ahead and raise your hands and I'll...
I just got a question on you. When you're talking about digital twins and kind of the nature of just open data sharing, like obviously there's different locations and locality that are going to have different access to like resources and quality. So I guess the question is like, how do you see the ability in like the open data ecosystem to communicate like where data is present, but then also like omission and in a way of like sharing, you know, where data you can have confidence in, and then also, I guess, like a secondary question, like in places where you understand that they're the data to be erroneous, how do you like communicate that back to the wider community, given that everything's so interconnected?
Fantastic question. So, you know, how do you kind of create a community standard for quality check and thing, right? I think that's, you know, that's where the exciting opportunity is for the community to figure out what would be the ways to do it, right? I can give you a small example that Aaron talked about, the Mapstar, okay? And it's a very simple concept, the Mapstar. And what Matt Larson, who is one of our colleagues working with warfighters, realized that the warfighters, you know, fly these drones, collect a lot of very high-resolution imagery, then they create 3D models, and when they're done, they either trash it or just put it on a hard drive, so the next person who comes in looks at all those files, and they are named like joe.a.1, right? So how many of you are going to open that file and try to find out anything, right? So what Mapstar does, it provides that standardization through automation. So the operator doesn't have to worry about it. So the software, the moment the software detects those files, it knows the metadata and it starts putting the base, it becomes, you know, organized and you know what it is. So our vision is that every time that data gets collected at the edge, if we can start standardizing within some established open standards, we can then pull it into the workflow that will update that part of that world, right? Today, we don't do it that way at all. So different agencies will have, you know, they have their established quality criteria, standards, and I don't think we are necessarily recommending that we walk away from it. It just has to be built into that workflow. And as long as we know what standards it has met, that's, you know, fairly good enough for the community. If you're talking about, you know, the en masse, what people do, you know, there are lots of lessons learned from OpenStreetMap and others. And I think that's where innovations can come, that how can you build in some of these approaches that will allow you to control that the quality and then also look for spuriousness, right? Spuriousness is it's an interesting topic. So thank you for the question.
I'm afraid we're out of time, so I'd like to thank Budu for his time. Let's give him a round of applause. Thank you.